on at the time. I can't remember what that was, but we were all tripping and digging it. It's a very personal thing, you know, on a very personal level. You can almost reach out and touch it, and it's very inviting to an artist. It's not like an untouchable Clear Channel type of organization where, you know, you're cast out. You're in. You're in. If you're in Houston, and probably if you're on the road and coming through Houston, you're probably more than invited to come to the studio. So it's just a great place to get your music out there, and I think it's a great place to be a music listener as well.
Listen for his music and other local artists here on KPFT.
Welcome to Amplified Houston. Bob Sanborn here from Children at Risk. Amplified Houston here on Pacifica Radio in Houston, Texas, 90.1 FM. Amplified Houston is a collaboration of the leading nonprofit organizations in Houston, Baker Ripley, the Boys and Girls Club of Greater Houston, Children at Risk, the Houston Food Bank, along with listener-sponsored commercial-free KPFT Radio. I'm Bob Sanborn, as I mentioned, President and CEO of Children at Risk. We have two fantastic guests today. I'm sure you're going to be interested in both of them. Professor Laura C. Chavez Moreno. She's a professor at UCLA and author of How Schools Make Race, Teaching Latinx Racialization in America. So we'll be talking with her in just a second. Our second guest in our second segment will be Nick Cantu of the Boys and Girls Club of Greater Houston, talking about after-school programs and the great programs that we have over at Boys and Girls Club. We now welcome Laura C. Chavez Moreno, author of How Schools Make Race, Teaching Latinx Racialization in America. Harvard University Press has it. Laura, how are you doing today?
Great, thank you. Good morning, and thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. So explain for those that don't know, and I have to say, I hadn't heard the term racialization, but explain for those that don't know what that means, Laura.
Sure, thank you. So racialization is about the process of how society constructs ideas about what is race and what are its racialized groups. And the important thing about racialization is that it's a process that has to do with distributing material resources inequitably. And that's actually how races are, or how racialized groups are made. So schools are an important institution in our society that contribute to this unequal distribution of resources, thus reinforce the idea that racialized groups exist and that there is this racial hierarchy.
And how might racialization sort of be taught in the United States, or how is it socialized in the United States, opposed to maybe in another country where, you know, if a Latino immigrant is growing up in Mexico, or I grew up in Puerto Rico, you know, how is it different here than it would be in another country or another place?
Really, question. Thank you. And this is a very important thing to know about race, is that race really differs based on the social context. So racialized groups are not the same in, for example, the U.S. versus other countries. They do differ. The idea, for example, to give you a concrete idea, in Guatemala, there's a racialized group called Ladino. This is different from Latinos. So in Guatemala, this group exists as a racialized group, whereas in the U.S., that group does not exist. We don't understand it. We don't organize our society by it, and we don't distribute resources based on that. Whereas in the U.S., There has been histories in, for example, creating a racial different racialized groups that are, for example, also different from Guatemala. So, for example, the group Latino, which we know here in the U.S., and I use the word Latinx, and I could talk about the X if you'd like, but Latinx or Latino in the U.S. exists as a racialized group, but it does not exist in, for example, Mexico, Guatemala, other places in Latin America. That's not really a group that those societies organize and distribute resources based on that.
And Professor, I wonder, how is it different within the United States, right? So you live in California, I live in Texas, you grew up in Arizona, I grew up in Puerto Rico. How might racialization exist in different states or areas of the United States?
Also a really important question, and thanks for asking. One of the things that my book contributes to is this understanding exactly of how this works differently based on where you are here in the U.S. There's a lot of research on what Latinx or what Latino is here in the U.S. So, for example, in California, in, for example, Miami and New York and some places in the Southwest, but there's much less research about how this concept of, for example, Latino, Latinx is being formed in the Midwest and other places that are considered not to have so many Latinos. The book takes place in the Midwest, in some schools in the Midwest. So it does offer, for people who are interested in exactly this question, it offers this perspective in terms of what's going on in terms of how are people thinking about what is this group Latino in the Midwest. And what I show is happening has to do with how the group is being compared to, for example, other racialized groups.
Mm-hmm. To me, this is a very interesting, you know, when it comes to the schools, it becomes very interesting because when we look at the fastest growing portion of our child population in the United States, it's Latino. And in Texas, as an example, I think it's 56% of all the kids in the schools, and when you go younger, it's bigger, so it's growing. They're Latino. In California, it's Latino, but really across the states, it's this fast growing portion. What should our schools be doing differently? And you talk about different racial groups because I go to Dallas, and we talk about race in Dallas, and people don't even talk about, they talk black and white. They don't talk about Latinos. What should the United States be doing in state by state or in regards to how we educate Latinos in our schools?
Thank you so much. Again, a super important question. One of the things that I examine in the book is how schools and how this bilingual education program is teaching about race and racialized ideas and racialized groups. And one of the things that I show in the book is that students are very interested in learning about race and learning about how our society works in terms of race. So in the study, the students have been in this program since elementary school, and I study in the middle school and in the high school. And what I find is that the students are very interested in learning about race. The problem is that because the U.S. has not committed to helping teachers teach about race, the students, by the time they got to high school, they told me that the lessons were very repetitive, that they were bored. And what I saw in the classroom was, in fact, that they were being repeated. Not all of them. And there was some lessons that I thought were very exciting because, for example, I never saw them when I was in high school, but the students had already learned them in middle school or elementary school. And then when they were kept they kept hearing this, they were bored of it and they just wanted to learn more. And one of the things I pose in the book is that we need to think about how to systematically teach about race, support teachers, and in teaching about race, and then also not think of the Latinx youth as only needing language. Again, remember I mentioned that I observed a bilingual education program. Lots of the focus was on language and how they need language and how they need to be Spanish speakers and perfect Spanish speakers, et cetera. And one of the things I'm arguing is that we also have to be conscious that bilingual education is also contributing to this distribution of resources and contributing to ideas about race. Thus, we can't just let bilingual education focus just on language. It also needs to focus on this social context, and race is a very important part of our social context.
As you did the research for your book, Laura, what were some of the more surprising findings, things that you found?
Yeah, very surprising finding was, again, like I mentioned, that teachers were actually teaching about race. I had anticipated going into the classrooms and really not finding any type of explicit instruction about that. And I was wrong. There was a lot. And what I noticed was that even though there was a lot, sometimes teachers felt unsupported, unsuccessful, and they spent a lot of time finding their own resources. So because it was a Spanish English bilingual program, there was a lot more resources to teach about race in English, but not a lot to teach, not in Spanish. So they had to either translate their own material or not use it at all, or use it but in English. So that also was not very helpful for teachers because they spent a lot of time finding it, translating, or whatever it is that they decided to do for that lesson. So there also has to be more intentional support for teachers who do take on this difficult work.
We're talking with Laura C. Chavez Moreno. She's the author of How Schools Make Race, Teaching Latinx Racialization in America. Laura, I wonder, in Texas, certainly, there is a lot of guilt amongst Latinos who don't speak Spanish. And if you go to San Antonio, as an example, there's a city of fifth and sixth generation Latinos, and primarily people don't speak Spanish, yet there's still a lot of guilt. How do you separate the idea of teaching a Latino identity from this idea that you don't speak the language?
Thank you so much. You know, it's interesting because I also noticed that guilt also in Arizona, where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have access to bilingual education programs. I'm a big advocate of them. And now the interesting thing about this linguistic guilt, perhaps, is that racialized groups, I'll go back to connect this to my research, racialized groups are things that people imagine how they're supposed to be, how they're supposed to be in terms of like how they should dress, how they should act, what kind of food or how they like, how are they supposed to dance, etc. Yeah. So here in the US, we have constructed this idea that Latinos have to or are imagined to be Spanish speakers. Now, this is tricky because that also is connected to the history of linguistic oppression and being forced to unlearn and forget your language, your home languages, right? So it's kind of like we're stuck kind of like in a double-edged sword in a way where it is true that this guilt exists, etc., and that is imagined in terms of what people should speak like or what they should know. But it is also true that not having your family language disconnects you from some type of cultural experience. So it is true, and it is a legacy of the racism that the U.S. the people have experienced racism here in the U.S.
Let me ask you a final question, Laura, and it's related to current politics. How difficult will it be to talk about these issues and for schools to teach about these issues under the upcoming Trump administration, right? I mean, there's so much anti-immigrant rhetoric, yet at the same time, we saw a growing number of Latinos vote for Trump. I mean, how will it be difficult for us to talk about this issue and implement some of these ideas in our schools?
Thank you so much. And you know, we hear a lot about how Latinos voted for Trump. One of the things that I also want to say is that although Latinos voted for Trump, Trump had more votes from all racialized groups. Mm-hmm. And really who put Trump in office are not Latinos, are not Black folks, it is white folks. Right. So that's just one thing that I do want to say.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing because people often think, well, overwhelmingly, no, it's because Latinos, unusually, a few of them voted for Trump. And I think that's an interesting dynamic. How tough will it be, though?
Yes, thank you. So it will be difficult. And in the U.S., we have had experience in terms of historically looking at the U.S. in terms of there being repression after some gains. So there have been some gains in terms of how schools are teaching about race. But after that, there's kind of this backlash. And we see this in history. So it has happened before. And what we would need to do is be students of that and know that we have to make sure to keep pressure and be organized.
Yeah, very good. Laura C. Chavez Moreno, she's the author of How Schools Make Race. She's out of UCLA, professor out there. Laura, thanks for your work. Thanks for getting up early for us this morning, too, by the way.
So excited. Thank you.
Yeah, keep up the great work. Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you.
Up in our next segment, we have Nick Cantu of the Boys and Girls Club of Greater Houston. Nick is with us. Nick, how are you doing this morning? Happy New Year, by the way.
Happy New Year. Thank you for having the Boys and Girls Club. We're excited.
Absolutely. So this is my favorite thing about the Boys and Girls Club is the membership dues that you guys have for kids. Tell us about what are the membership dues for kids at the Boys and Girls Club?
They're currently $10 for a membership for a school year.
See that?
And then, yeah.
Just so I love
and
it.
And then 25 for our summer program, which is 10 weeks. And, you know, we look at the, you know, we want it to be affordable, but we're also looking at, we also want our families to have a buy-in to our programs and buy into our organization. And so we're looking at different models in the upcoming year, because it does, you know, for it to be so reasonably inexpensive for our families, we also still want them to have a buy-in to what we do and what we believe in. And so we're looking at the new model, but it also puts a lot of pressure on our development team for fundraising efforts to make sure funding is coming in so that we can do all the exciting programs that we offer our young people.
When you think about the work that you guys do at Boys and Girls Club, and I know you guys do a lot, but I think many people think of you as primarily an after-school program, right? Mm-hmm. When you think about that, what's the difference that you're making in the lives of kids? I mean, what's the difference between a young student who goes to Boys and Girls Club after school as opposed to someone who doesn't?
Yeah, great question. Well, we believe that, you know, we are a very comprehensive after school program, just like any of our other competitors in the greater Houston area that offer after school programming. But what we believe in the Boys and Girls Club is that when you come to the Boys and Girls Club, we're going to offer you an experience that is going to be carried when you leave our doors, when you're in the school setting, when you are at home. You want to be a good citizen. You want to be a rule follower. And all of our programs and everything that we offer in our after-school program, it's very comprehensive. It's very vetted. It is for that individualized community, because we do a lot of surveying in that particular community, asking the families, asking our young people, what do you guys want to see? We believe that we want to be an extension of the instructional day in that community.
This might be a tough question, Nick, but you know, in our previous segment, we were talking about Latinos, and you and I both know that this fast-growing population of Latino mm-hmm. children, students in our community. One of the things that some of our research has found is that Latino students are least likely to engage in team sports. When you think about sort of that idea of organized physical activity amongst the young Latino population, How is Boys and Girls Club sort of changing that in terms of getting young students to be physically active, getting young students to sort of not only have a good academic lifestyle, which I know you guys do a good job of, but getting back to your roots of sort of that athletic background?
Yeah. So one of our one of our core areas, yes, is academic success, healthy lifestyles, good citizenship and good character, and life and workforce readiness. But in our healthy lifestyles, we focus a lot in young sports, such as our flag football, such as our big shot, best shot basketball, our soccer program, our baseball program, because we believe that the young people that are going to be taking advantage of our services, most of the time they come to us, they did not make the high school basketball team or the outdoor soccer team. So we make it to where everybody who participates can engage in those activities. Because what we're also finding in our collaboration with the school districts is that we hear that we have some of our teens who want to play volleyball, but have never played volleyball, and they want to go into ninth grade and or middle school, and they want to try out for the team, but have never played. So we try to, as being a comprehensive after school program, and we believe that giving these opportunities at a middle size, high size level, that the young people can take these opportunities and go and try out in the school once we've provided you those resources. And it's our partnerships such as Houston Rockets, the Houston Astros, the Dynamo. Those are really the Houston Texans. You know, they're very instrumental in partnering up with us and providing these opportunities so that, and these resources, so that our staff can provide these opportunities to the young people we serve.
When you look across our community, Nick, and you see, the high percentage of kids growing up in low-income households, the challenges that they face, you know, what's your, when you guys are all together, all the big brains over there at Boys and Girls Club, what is your biggest worry that you have for students moving into the future?
Well, our biggest worry has always been, number one, funding. And do our state representatives, do they believe in after school programming? Do they believe in what our work is? Do they? And so that's why we have taken on, you know, meeting with our local community council, our city council members, our commissioners from the five counties that we are located in. It is our passion to get in front of them and let them know that why we exist. Why is after school so important? And Boys and Girls Club, you know, we're located in five different counties. And most of the time we are in economically disadvantaged communities, but it is important that we're getting the message out. And so these type of platforms and our partnerships with Children at Risk and our different partners to get the message out how important after school programming is. And so that when get it into the right state representatives, that funding is needed. Our biggest concern is, number one, is the funding. Two is so school districts right now, because we like to partner with school districts, because some of the families, they don't want their kids to leave the school and go to an off-site after-school program. So that's why we work to make sure that we have strong partnerships so that we can stay on-site, so that it gives a little bit more comfort to the families that don't feel comfortable that their children have to travel off-site. But most school districts don't have the funding. So we're hustling, trying to find the best avenues and resources to be able to open up in a lot of communities. And finally, what we are seeing is that communities that need us the most, they don't have the resources, and we can't go into those communities and provide the services. But we're working hard at that table, trying to come up with strategies and ways to best serve our communities that we're in.
Yeah. When you think about these low-income families, and, certainly we've seen, in the 20 years that I've been at Children at Risk and we've monitored the data, things are getting better for low-income kids, right? I mean, we see more of the high-performing schools in high-poverty areas. Still not nearly enough. And part of that is, pre-K programs. Part of it is academically based after-school programs. What do you guys see as some of the changes that you need to make as we move into the future to make sure we have more kids that are operating at these higher academic levels, especially those kids that are coming from low-income families?
Well, number one is getting into these school districts. Yeah. And working with the various school districts that we are operating at, and really understanding, okay, what is this school district's focus? Is their focus on reading, math? What are the things that we as the Boys and Girls Club can be an extension of what their learning is, so that we can offer as much service as we can to our young people? To making sure that the school districts, so that the school districts understand that we are a comprehensive after school program that can also help. We want to just be, small little nuggets that we can do in the after school hours that can benefit their instructional day. That is what we want to be. We want to be recognized so that the school districts can come. We have some really great partnerships with Spring Branch ISD, Fort Bend ISD, Lamar CISD, all these school districts. And we rely on our frontline staff, our club directors, to be meeting with campus administration. What can our staff in the after school program do? when members register for our Boys and Girls Club, we also ask for a copy of their report card, because we want to see the growth of our young people. We want to see their behavior. We want to see, are we seeing them pass their, you know, their grades, you know, and it is important to us to really examine that so that we can be part of that. It's a lot of great work coming up in 2025 that we believe the Boys and Girls Club is positioning to be that beacon in those communities, that we can really offer some really high quality programming.
Nick, our families, I did an interview with Univision day before yesterday where the reporter asked me about, you know, she mentioned how Latino students and Latino families are very worried about the upcoming administration, what could happen to them, especially those that may have one member that's undocumented, but even those that everyone's documented, they're still very worried, you know, about what could happen. Do you see any of that reflection in some of the students, some of the kids over there, Boys and Girls Club? You guys doing anything to prepare for the coming year?
Yeah, I mean, normally what we do as an organization is, one, we don't want people to be alarmed, and, you know, we don't want them to be, it's business as usual. However, you know, we also still take it very seriously. And what we as an organization are is doing is finding ways to making sure that all our, you know, we're in compliance as an organization, and yeah, we're making sure that we have everything readily available. But what we also do is we prepare, you know, you know, just like anything that we do in our organization for inclement weather, for anything, we as an organization, we still are going to prepare for what could possibly happen or what might not happen. But we also want to prepare our staff just as if in anything, you know, in the trauma-informed world, you know, we'll continue our trauma-informed professional development, offer those services. We will also, you know, registration process may be a little bit different sometimes if it gets, we see some things happening in the community. We will not allow anybody not to register if they don't feel comfortable doing these things. We as an organization, we will adjust as we see. Of course, you know, anybody in the Latino community is going to be concerned and scared. And so we're going to try to minimize as much of it as possible by providing any resources or anything readily available to our families and to our staff.
It's a whole new dynamic in Texas, I think. It sure is.
You know, and we as an organization, you know, we have to take this inclement weather very seriously. So now we have a whole plan around inclement weather. So, you know, and we as an organization, we take things now, okay, everything that we do now has an intention, and it's intentional, and we make sure that we position ourselves to prepare for the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Absolutely. Nick Cantu is over at the Boys and Girls Center of Greater Houston, part of a great team out there that does really wonderful work. And thank you, Nick, so much for the work that you guys are doing. Please give our regards to your whole team, and we so appreciate it. You do nice stuff.
All right, appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Happy New Year's, Nick. And all of us here at Amplified Houston, we thank you guys very, very much. We'll see you next time here on Amplified Houston on Pacifica Radio.
It's now or never. Come hold me tight. Kiss me, my darling.
It's 90.1 KPFT. Time to check in with the R&R show.
The man is already blowing all of his New Year's resolutions.
Talking about yourself?
No, I don't. You know, me and the resolutions thing. Why jack with perfection? You know. I just, you know, I'm just not going to get involved with having to change and alter my state. You've heard of an altered state, right?
Oh yeah, I've heard of an altered state. All right.
Yeah. See,
kind of wish I was in an altered state right about now.
And of course, we are starting off officially 2025. Whoever thought we would have made it this far, especially us.
Yeah, kind of incredible when you think about it.
And Tom and I are just ready to roll on.
Enjoy the great decades of music, fun, and banter with R&R, weekdays 1 till 3 here on KPFT.
This is Steve Earle, and you're listening to KPFT Houston Pacifica Radio for Peace.
stepping stone. No, I'm not your stepping stone.
Will you try to make your mark on society?